Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair, Commissioners. So today, I guess I should start. My name's Penny Becker, and I'm the Acting Diversity Division Manager.
And I'm Gary Wiles. I'm a biologist with the Diversity Division.
And so this afternoon, we're going to focus on giving you a briefing based on the classification of endangered, threatened, and sensitive wildlife, and specifically give you some information about the tufted puffin and the stellar sea lion and some recommendations that we're putting forward. And then we'll discuss this again at the March meeting and ask for a decision on the classification of those two species. So since it's been quite a while since we've been to you all to talk about a change in classification for a species, we thought it'd be a good idea to start with a brief summary of the process and the authorities that are involved. So RCW 77.120 authorizes the commission to classify wildlife as endangered or protected species. So within protected is also threatened and sensitive wildlife. And that RCW allows us to identify and classify native wildlife in the need of protection so that we can ensure their survival here in Washington State. So the major categories we have for classification are endangered, so seriously threatened with extinction throughout all or a significant portion of their range within the state. Threatened, which means they're likely to become endangered within the foreseeable future if we don't remove the threats that are acting on them. And sensitive, which means that they're vulnerable or declining and they're going to get to an endangered or a threatened status if we don't remove the threats and manage them. So we have an administrative code that guides the process for our listing. The first step in that process is to identify species that are potentially of concern in the state. And then we have a policy that designates those species as candidates. Then, of course, we look to gather more information on those species, conduct any surveys to fill information gaps, go back to the literature, and do any research that's needed to understand the species status more. And then we put all that information together in a status review or report to recommend a classification to the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So that's what we're going to be doing today. If the species is listed by the commission, then we're also guided to write a recovery plan for that species. So we work within WDFW and with our partners to pull together what are those actions that we need to do to recover those species and get them back to healthy populations in our state. And then, of course, the most important step is to implement recovery actions. So working with our conservation partners and our own staff on the ground, doing those actions to be able to recover those species. So that can be everything from habitat restoration to range reductions and everything in between. And then we look at the response of that population across the state to those actions and keep monitoring the status of those species through time. And for the listed species, the WAC also guides that on a periodic basis that we pull together a status report to be able to let you know how the species is doing and if we are being successful. If we are successful, then we'd be looking at either downlisting, so for instance from endangered to threatened or sensitive, or delisting, taking the species off our protected species list. And of course, in that process, if we find that those management actions haven't resulted in a healthier population, then we would also be looking to recommend a higher status for the species. So if it was listed as sensitive, we might ask for threatened, for example. So today, what you have in your binders, and certainly we'll have some time to pour over, is a draft status report, and those status reports are for our candidate species, those that aren't yet listed, and a periodic status review, which is for a species that is listed. So the draft status report is for the tufted puffin, and the periodic status review for the stellar sea lion. We focus in there on the current status of the species and the population and habitat characteristics, any ecological relationships between different species and their habitats. We look at the management actions that are currently in play and how those are negatively or positively affecting the species in question. and then talk about those threats that are still continuing to act on the species. And of course, we take all of that information and we put it through a pretty intense internal and external peer review. So that review process includes our own DFW scientists, as well as any species experts from other agencies and from universities and other places. The public review process comes next, and so all of our reports currently go through a 3-month review where the public can comment on those online. And all of those comments are responded to and then collated and included in our final report with a final listing recommendation from the department. And then next, that goes through a State Environmental Policy Act review, where we also collect more public comments. And all of those things are available to you in your binders. And then we present them at the commission meeting for a decision. So the major effects of a state listing are, of course, it increases the public awareness and provides some education that there's a conservation concern at play here for that species. It also helps us at DFW set our priorities with several hundred species, like Cynthia talked about this morning. Which ones are we going to focus on, and which habitats are we going to work on to be able to help our listed species? It also notifies other agencies and local governments of increased concern about the species and helps us to coordinate with them better to manage those species and recover them. And then, of course, we've got a restriction on harassment and killing directly of those species. And like I said before, we get to pull together a recovery plan with our partners that outlines all of the necessary actions needed to recover the species and really focuses any research on where are the threats for these species and how we can better manage them to recover them.
All right, we thought we'd start with the Tufted Puffin presentation first, and then we'll follow that with this Stellar Sea Lion presentation. So Tufted Puffins are currently a state candidate species. They were added to the list in 1998 because of some preliminary information that the population had been declining. And today we're recommending to you that the species may be made an endangered species in the state of Washington. All the information that we'll be providing today can be found in the status report for the Tufted Puffin, and I hope you'll look through that and just learn a little bit more about the species. We were approached, it's probably been 4 years ago already now, by Dr. Joe Gatos of the Sea Doc Society and asked if we, being the diversity division, would be interested in having his organization fund a first draft status report on tufted puffins. And we said we would be quite interested in that. So the organization contracted out with Dr. Tor Hansen to provide a first draft. And Tor did an excellent job on that. And he is here, by the way, in the audience today, and I think he'll be giving comments later on. So we took the first draft from Tor, and then we did some additional work on it, mainly some minor edits. We expanded some of the sections a little bit with additional information. And then we also took it through the review process that Penny just described for you. I'll give you a little bit of information on natural history of tufted puffins. They're one of the largest alcids. The alcid family is comprised of murrelets, murres, and auklets also. Tufted puffins are distributed across the North Pacific. They range from California up to Alaska and down to Japan. And during the breeding season, they all come in coastally to nest. And then during the wintertime, they assume a much more pelagic distribution, so they go out to sea at that time of the year. Species changes its plumage seasonally, so you may be familiar with the bright breeding plumage that's shown in the top photo there. The bottom photo shows what the species looks like in the wintertime. It becomes much drabber at that time. Puffins nest on islands and headlands where they're a little safer from terrestrial predators. They're great swimmers, and they feed exclusively underwater. Diet is comprised of forage fish and invertebrates. There's never been a study on diet here in Washington, but based on similar studies in British Columbia and Alaska, we can assume that sand lance, herring, juvenile rockfish, eulachon, and other forage fish are a major part of the diet. Breeding takes place in the summer from about April to September. The birds dig burrows for their eggs for the most part, and those burrows are placed on grassy slopes that are steep and also on bluffs that have deep soil for digging. The two uppermost photos here show a couple of our breeding islands in Washington. The top one is Carroll Island, and that colony once held 10,000 puffins in it. But the size of it today is down to, I think, about 211 was the most recent count. Second photo there is from Destruction Island. It's a much lower island, but the birds still use it, and you can see some of the seabird burrows there in the foreground. So puffins have a clutch size of one egg. The egg hatches around 1st of July. It takes 6 to 8 weeks for the chick to become of fledging age, and that occurs in August and September. So we'll go into the reasons that we believe tufted puffins should be made an endangered species here next. They were once one of the most common seabirds we have in the state, and I'll present four sets of evidence describing the decline for you to see, and all of these provide they provide a very similar story of major declines taking place. So I'll start here first with minimum population estimates that we have for the state. We only have three of those. First was made over a century ago, and it was estimated that the outer coast had about 25,000 birds at a minimum. The next count wasn't done until 1978 to 82 during the preparation of the Washington Seabird Catalog. And at that time, based on colony counts, again, about 23,000 birds were estimated. But the authors thought that the population could be up to 50% larger than that. And then we also have data more recently from 2009. These are based on nearshore transects done along the outer coast only. So about 3,000 birds then, and that is also a minimum. That was only birds on the water were counted, and birds that were on the breeding colonies in their burrows would not have been observed, and birds farther out to sea probably weren't counted as well. So this trend, or this pattern in counts, shows a very obvious decline in puffin numbers since about 1980. And, in fact, there's some informal evidence based on people's general observations that much of the decline took place in the mid-'80s to late 1990s. And this decline follows a very similar pattern to what is going on in California, Oregon, and Japan. All those locations at the southern part of the range have seen major declines. Next, we'll talk about the declines in colony size and distribution here in Washington. So this table shows three time periods. In the first column there, 1886 to 1977, that's our historical baseline, more or less. We know of 44 colonies that existed in the state. Most of those were in the smaller size ranges, but we did have seven colonies at the time that numbered 1,000 or more birds. In 1978 to 1984, we had a total of 35 known colonies, so that represented a 20% decline by that time. But we still had large colonies in the state, so there were still at least six colonies then that numbered 1,000 or more birds. Now, if we move ahead to the most recent period, 2007 to 10, you can see there inside the red circle that we've had a total loss of larger colonies, and we now have only 19 in the smaller two categories. So that represents a 57% decline in total occupied sites. If you combine the information for the first two columns, we actually have a total of 9 historical colonies that once supported 1,000 or more birds. But the highest count we have today, highest count we have currently is 211 birds for the state. And we only have 2 colonies that have more than 200 birds. And also of note is that of the 19 current colonies that exist, only 3 of those have numbers similar to what they had in the 1978 to 84 period. So this this graphic shows the data that, or shows graphically the information I just presented in the table. So the top 3 panels show the outer coast, and with different colonies of different sizes depicted by the various colors there. So in the early period, there were 31. Well, that's the upper left-hand most panel. We had 31 historical sites out on the outer coast. And you can see a number of those are orange and purple colored. And those would have been the largest sized colonies. The situation looks pretty similar for the 1978 to 84 period, but there was some drop off in colony numbers. But then by the most recent period, you can see that we've lost all of the larger orange and purple symbols. And there's been a decline down to 17 sites on the outer coast now. Bottom 3 panels show the San Juans and the Eastern Strait. We had originally 13 colonies known for that portion of Washington, with 11 of those in the San Juans. By the middle time period, 1978 to 84, the San Juans were obviously losing some of their colonies. And then by the most recent period, puffins are totally gone from the San Juans. We have just 2 sites remaining in the inner waters. Those are Smith Island and Protection Island. And combined, those total just 60 birds total. Let's see here. All right, our third set of evidence comes from declining numbers during boat-based surveys. We have 2 sets of data there, and they both show significant losses of birds. The first set of data comes from the Westport Seabird Tour Company that's owned and operated by our own Phil Anderson. And that data shows from 1972 to 2001, 13.6% average rate of decline per year. The second set of data is nearshore surveys that were conducted from 2001 to 12. So this brings us right up to the present. It shows that, this gives information on the current trend in the population. So it shows an ongoing loss of almost 9% per year on average.
Marble Merlet surveys, right?
These counts are done primarily for marble murrelets, but other species, including puffins, are recorded on them. And this data is gathered by the Fish and Wildlife Service, our agency, and the Forest Service. So lastly, I'll talk about declines in attendance at colonies. And we have data sets for 2 islands. First one is for Tatoosh Island. This is data gathered by Dr. Robert Payne at the University of Washington. And so from 1983 to 2001, he recorded an annual decline rate of, on average, of almost 17% at that colony. Protection Island, the Fish and Wildlife Service has data for there from 1973 to 2001, and they recorded an almost 14% average rate of decline at that island. I'll touch on real briefly on threats to puffins, and I guess maybe the most important thing to say is we don't know why this population has declined in Washington. hasn't been very well studied to date. So we have a lot to learn about it, but I'll list some potential causes here. First is reduced prey availability. Prey availability is a very important factor for all seabird populations, and it strongly affects their productivity. So this might be something you would expect could be impacting our population. We know that at least several forage fish species have declined in Washington, including herring and rockfish. For rockfish, it's the juveniles that puffins feed on. But for some other forage fish, maybe populations aren't that much different now than what they were historically. Climate change is more of a future threat. It can affect prey availability for sure, with many forage fish, I believe, decline during periods of warmer ocean temperatures. Sea level rise can also affect a couple of our colonies that are low-lying and are susceptible to erosion, which can impact the burrowing seabird. Bycatch in fishing nets was formerly a problem, mostly pelagically. We don't have much information on this for Washington, but in the 70s and 80s, tens of thousands of puffins were killed every year in net entanglements. So that problem has been resolved largely, I believe. Mortality from oil spills and contaminants. We have done a good job of preventing oil spills over the last couple of decades, but we still have risk involved there. And certainly with all the proposals for increased oil shipment in Washington and surrounding areas, this risk could go up in the future. We have information from one spill, the Tenu Maru, which took place in 91 off the outer mouth of the strait, and that was estimated to have killed 10% or 9% of the puffin population in Washington. Regarding contaminants, we don't have much data in this area, but opportunistically, a single freshly dead carcass was picked up at Smith Island in 2009 and was sent off for testing, and it came back with extremely high levels of PCBs, DDTs, and flame retardants. And, you may expect this problem to be more pronounced in the inner waters, but probably you wouldn't expect contaminants to be a big deal on the outer coast. We also have some impacts from introduced species. European rabbits have been introduced to Destruction Island, where they cause where they overgraze and cause erosion, and they also compete with puffins for burrows. And then we have non-native plants at Protection Island in the nesting area, and they could be at other islands too. They haven't been well surveyed, to my knowledge, yet. Bald eagles have recovered tremendously in Washington since the 1970s. They're known predators of puffins, and puffins show avoidance behavior when eagles are close by. Harmful algal blooms. Oh, back to eagles for just one more statement is that many of our offshore islands do have very large eagle populations now. Harmful algal blooms, probably more of a threat in the future with climate change. We don't have any examples of puffins dying from this, but there was a large bloom that took place off the coast in 2009, and it killed large numbers of marine birds. The only reason puffins escaped that, perhaps, is because it happened in the fall and they had already gone to sea. And human disturbance is also historically was a big deal with puffins. They're very sensitive to human activity, but this is because of management of the nesting islands. This isn't such a issue any longer. And just a couple further items to point out regarding puffin management and conservation here in Washington. So nearly all islands are part of the, this would be both historical and current islands, they're part of the Washington Maritime National Wildlife Refuge Complex. So they receive protection from the service. And then many of the former islands in the San Juans are also designated as wilderness. Regarding the outer coastal waters surrounding our nesting colonies, Most of those waters are part of the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary, administered by NOAA. And then finally, Fish and Wildlife Service received a petition from the Natural Resources Defense Council in 2014 to consider listing puffins either as threatened or endangered under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And the service has indicated that they'll begin that evaluation in 2016 or 17, and that'll probably take a couple of years to work through. And then lastly, wanted to touch on the comments that we received from the public, both in the 90-day comment period and then also the shorter 14-day SEPA period. So we received 27 comments from people, and overwhelmingly they voiced support for listing. 23 people actually stated that. We had one person opposed to listing. And a few people expressed concerns about human disturbance and declining forage fish. One wondered whether there are too many double-crested cormorants now, that whether they might be having an impact. And the two species don't overlap very much, so not considered a threat. And then we also had one person who didn't like the report at all and thought that it was full of bad science. And we also finally received some very useful technical comments from Seattle Audubon Society. So with that, we'll ask if you have any questions about puffins.
Or about the listing procedures.
Mr. Mangan?
Yeah. Just a comment. I had a heronry on my property with 150 nesting pairs on Bainbridge Island that was completely decimated by eagles. When the eagle population began to grow, they began to prey on the not only on the juvenile birds, but on the adult birds eventually. And now you're telling me that you have eagle populations. What happens if we find that, in fact, the eagles are the cause of the decline in the puffin?
Occasionally, we run into these issues where we have, sometimes it's endangered species versus endangered species. In this case, it would be a recovered species and an endangered species. And so it's a case-by-case basis, obviously, right? There's a lot of protections for our eagles that are in place, and so it's a larger issue that would have to be addressed, of course, with our federal partners as well. So
what would be, how would you address something like that?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I mean, there are certainly some ways to do some take of under the Migratory Bird Act. So on a case-by-case basis, it would be a potential to look at to help bolster some endangered species, to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service to see if that is a potential way to go about that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Mr. Wecker?
Since you're fielding easy questions, you know, one of the big conundrums is that as climate changes, the range changes for species, and you have these larger scale dynamics that you see driving decline.
Yep.
It's really difficult to recalibrate our objectives, our goals, if the range that once had abundant populations realistically can no longer support abundant populations. It becomes from an edge of the range.
That's right.
So how do we get ourselves into the situation of raising expectations that there will be recovery, but sometimes it's just not realistic. So,
yeah,
what's your thoughts on that?
I guess I'll start by saying that's a very astute question. We are on the periphery of lots of different species range here in Washington, and so we see that. With puffins in particular, we don't have currently any evidence to say that our populations are growing just north of us, and so it's likely not just a contraction of the range or a movement of those birds, but potentially a real decline. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, I guess it's Stellar Sea Lion time.
All right. Okay, so the second species we're going to talk about is the Stellar Sea Lion. And it was listed by the Fish and Wildlife Commission in 1993 as a threatened species. And today we're going to put forward our recommendation to delist the species based on its current population status and growth, and biologically it's looking in healthy shape. But it will still retain some protected status. There's another protected species under WAC 232-12011. It basically says that there's a level of protection for all pinnipeds. So there'll still be some protection in place for this species if it were delisted. The periodic status review for this species was initiated just after the NOAA went ahead with their federal status review and delisting of the eastern distinct population segment of Stellar Sea Lion. And this was solely a WDFW Diversity Division-led draft, and then we took it through the public comment period with lots of review from experts. So it's one of the largest pinnipeds, and it is pretty widely distributed all the way down from California up to Alaska and down to Japan. There's two recognized distinct population segments. So we are in the eastern DPS, and there's also the western DPS. You can see that divide there on the map at 144 west. So as I said before, the eastern DPS is now delisted federally, and the western DPS still retains its federal status. We've got two species of sea lions in our Washington waters, and they're often confused with each other, get each other into trouble sometimes, I think. And even though there's a big difference between those two species, so the California sea lions are much smaller and much more common. Just for comparison, the males of the Stellar Sea Lions can get to up to 2,500 pounds. The males for California's are only about 1,000. And the females, Stellar Sea Lions are 770, and then you have much smaller, 240 pounds for the female California Sea Lions. So big difference there. So we find them on both rookeries and on haul-out sites. So rookeries are where the sea lions are breeding. It's mostly on islands and offshore rocks from May through August. And the adults are there. They're defending territories and vying for some females' attention. And the females are producing pups every 1 to 3 years. So they're not necessarily reproducing every year. Those haul-outs are used year-round for rest and for sunbathing. And you find them on natural structures like islands, as well as lots of man-made structures, too. This is a highly mobile species. So females are sticking around about 500 kilometers from their rookeries, but juveniles can go much farther. So what that means is here in Washington, we have animals that are visiting us from Southeast Alaska, British Columbia, California, and Oregon. So those are obviously animals that are going to be feeding in our Washington waters as well. And so they do most of their feeding about 60 kilometers, within 60 kilometers of shore, and they eat whatever is most readily available. So usually that's fish and cephalopods like squid. We have 6 Washington-specific diet studies for this species that have called out in 3 of those as hake being particularly important for Stellar Sea Lions, but a whole variety of different forage fish. And then, of course, at Bonneville Dam, they use what's available, which is white sturgeon and salmonids. We have 22 haul-out sites in Washington, with 8 of those are on the outer coast, with the largest Bodelte Island, when we get up to 2,000 individuals, which is a significant portion of our population there on that one island. We have 14 haul-outs in the inner waters, and they often are using what's most available there, which are man-made structures. And then, of course, we've got haul-outs in nearby Oregon, 3 of those, and in British Columbia, so a lot of crossover use into Washington waters. So when there was initially conservation concern for this species, it was in the 1970s for sure, and we just had a couple hundred individuals. But now what we're seeing throughout the eastern DPS is a significant increase in non-pup numbers. So that's any sea lion that's over a year old is a non-pup. And so across the DPS, about 3% change positively. And then you can see we've got an even larger uptick here in Washington. We've grown about 9%. And then across Southeast Alaska, BC, and Oregon, you get similar trends of increasing numbers of adults and yearlings. And our summer trend count of non-pups at 4 haul-out sites that we watch specifically have gone from 250 to 300 individuals all the way up to 2,157 this last year. Across the eastern DPS, we've also seen an increase in pup numbers. So here in Washington, we technically don't have any formal rookeries. I'm told that the formal definition was something that was established with 50, a selected arbitrary number, and they have to be retained. 50 individuals consistently are born there for 5 years in a row. So we don't quite have that in Washington, but we've had consistent breeding in Washington since 1992. But across the DPS, as you can see in those graphs there, we've got some significant increases in pup production, and because they do move so widely, we're seeing a lot of those individuals coming into Washington waters when they get older. And then finally, the entire population in the eastern DPS has increased pretty dramatically from about 18,000 to 70,000 in 2010. So big recovery for this species. So next I'm going to talk about some potential threats that are acting on stellar sea lions, but I guess it's important to note here that even though these threats might be acting on this species, it's not stopping the population from growing pretty well. So one of the things that Gary addressed was climate change, and you'll see several of the same threats that are potentials for sea lions, and that's a future threat, and it can affect certainly the forage fish species that are available, sea level rise, so those haul-outs and rookeries might be affected, and then any diseases and parasites that become more widespread. Reduced prey availability, so in the western DPS, it's one of those threats that's been called out as a major factor for them. And we've got many fisheries in Washington. Obviously, it has not been negatively affecting our population. And human disturbance at haul-outs and rookeries can be a major issue. It can cause abandonment, disruptive behavior, stampeding, and we actually might lose pups that way. And, of course, that can happen in the water as well with vessel traffic and any potential energy development. One of the issues that we deal with stellar sea lions is some incidental take, so related to fishing gear entanglement, ingesting hooks. Of course, we've got way too much trash in our ocean, and so things like packing bans can become a major problem for both seabirds and for marine mammals. And an ongoing threat is the illegal intentional killing by fishermen, so obviously both on the federal and state level, we work on enforcing that. Environmental contaminants can also be an issue, and this has been something that we've looked at for lots of marine mammals. We know that in the Salish Sea that the PCB levels are at an unhealthy level for harbor seals. Oil spills, like Gary outlined, of course, are a potential threat. and in the future any algal blooms. We know that California sea lions are susceptible to domoic acid poisoning related to that, but we don't yet know how that will affect stellar sea lions, probably similarly. And then predation. Our killer whales sometimes take our stellar sea lions too. And actually, that's been pointed out in the Western DPS as one of the factors that's keeping that population down. So some other management and conservation for this species is that our haul-out sites, just as with the puffin, a lot of those sites are protected. We have the same thing for our stellar sea lions. So we have the Washington Maritime National Wildlife Refuge Complex that protects a lot of our sites. And then the outer coast, we have the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary. So other things that are going on, as I mentioned before, the Eastern DPS was delisted in 2014 under the Endangered Species Act, but of course those federal protections still remain for stellar sea lion under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And if it's delisted in the state of Washington, it would still remain protected as protected wildlife under our current WAC. But it would provide, on a case-by-case basis, the potential for some limited lethal removal for management of other endangered species, for instance, which is similar to your question. So, but that would have to go through federal and state law. So we received 51 comments and one petition on this during the 90-day comment period and during the SEPA comment period. Most of them were support for delisting, 26. We got 12 that were opposed, plus a petition with 74 names. Several expressed that sea lions were too abundant, and I think one of the things that allows us an educational opportunity is the difference between California sea lions and stellar sea lions. A lot of folks don't see that, so they just talk about sea lions in general and their abundance. They talked about impacts to fish stocks and human safety and beach pollution. There were folks on the other side that said that sea lions shouldn't be blamed for human-caused problems to fish stocks. Several said lethal control was needed for sea lions. Others said they were worried about lethal control for sea lions. Some said that it benefited local economy through wildlife watching, and others said that it was bad for the local economy. And so it was a balanced number of folks who commented. Any questions on the stellar sea lion?
No questions. Very good report.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have five, pardon me,
question.
Commissioner Wayne.
Remind me again, what's the next step for considering delisting of stellar sea lions?
So for both the puffin and the sea lion decision, we'll come back to you in March at the meeting and
ask
for
Moses Lake.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we'll travel over to Moses Lake. In the meantime, you have both the SEPA documents as well as the reports if you want to look at them over in the meantime.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Director Unsworth.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. So what... you had a long list of threats. What is the list of things that allowed them to increase from 18,000 to 70,000? Was it just protection?
It was primarily protection from illegal killing. It really made all the difference, I think.
Commissioner Wecker.
I guess we really shouldn't get into what happens after we delisted, if we do delist stellar sea lions. But they're still protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
That's right.
They're still listed under federal law.
No.
And I think there's a proposed, no?
I think they were removed from the federal listing.
They were delisted federally?
Yes, so in the Eastern DPS, they were delisted. So the federal protections that remain are the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Marine Mammal Protection Act. So, which is stringent in its protection.
Mm-hmm.
Is there just an overall message that you can give us, you know, just the gist of what new tools we might have to to deal with the impacts of stellar sea lions on endangered salmon?
Mm-hmm. So I'm certainly not the expert on what's been going on with that, but I know that on a limited basis, there's been some work at Bonneville that's been working with California sea lions and tracking particular individual sea lions that are involved with high levels of predation there. And so those individuals are tracked, and our marine mammal person who's sitting just behind me can probably answer this a little bit better, but there are some management tools available to us then.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, if there's no other questions, we will move into the public input period. We have five people who have signed up. Commission policy is that we allow you 3 minutes. At the end of 3 minutes, please promptly finish your sentence, and we'll go on to the next one. So I'm going to call them up two at a time so we can go get this done. Thor Hansen and Peter Hodum, if I have that correctly.
First of all, thank you for holding this hearing and for allowing and inviting public comment. It's very nice to be with you here today. I'm Thor Hansen, and I'm here as a co-author of the status report for the Tufted Puffin with Gary, and also to represent the Sea Dog Society, which is an NGO, a nonprofit that, as Gary mentioned in his report, hired me to help initiate the status report process. So my first comment is somewhat procedural, but it's simply to stress how successful we all feel that this public-private partnership has been. Leveraging nonprofit, privately raised money to help with the listing documentation is really, in a sense, a very good value for taxpayers. And it's also a great model for addressing other candidate species who have been on the list for a long time and helping to deal with that backlog. I want to say personally that Gary and his colleagues, Scott Pearson, Jane Jenkerson, and others have been outstanding to work with throughout this process, and I think and hope that everyone is happy with the result. So also to say that for future partnerships, should they occur, I hope they will follow this model of close collaboration where there is full co-authorship with department staff, and resulting in a document that's fully vetted within the department so that it meets the standards and styles that that you all are used to. As I told Gary while we were working on this, I said, if someone has a problem with this at the end, I have a feeling it's going to be your phone that rings before mine, so we'd better get it right. I really have nothing of a scientific nature to add today. I think the report speaks for itself, and in fact, when Jane first produced that map that you all saw during the presentation of the big dots, many big dots getting smaller and fewer over time, I told Gary, well, that's sort of the whole story, isn't it? I mean, what are we writing the rest of this thing for? It really is a clear and dramatic and continuing decline for tufted puffins from multiple data sets over time, and we do feel very indicative of an endangered status. But I do want to encourage you to keep this momentum going. Following the decision you make in March, I hope that the next steps, whatever they may be, recovery plan, management actions, will receive the highest priority. Because reports aside, it's really only then that we'll know we've done our utmost to keep this wonderful bird as a part of our fauna. And finally, I want to point out that any action taken on behalf of tufted puffins, whether it's removing invasive species from their nesting habitat or doing something to improve forage fish stocks, will likely benefit other marine birds as well, including other candidate species like the common murre or the Brandt's cormorant. There are many climate models predicting tough times ahead for these fish-eating marine birds in our region. And it's my hope that in taking action on tufted puffins now will help ensure that we're not all back here in this room in a decade or two talking about rhinoceros auklets or pelagic cormorants or other species that today may seem quite common. So again, thank you for the chance to comment.
Thank you. Elizabeth Roddick, if I get that correct. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Peter Hodum. I'm a professor of conservation biology at the University of Puget Sound, and I've been involved in seabird ecology and conservation work for about 25 years now, and including tufted puffin work here in Washington. So I've been involved in tufted puffin work along with Scott Pearson, who's a DFW senior research scientist since 2005. And some of our data have actually been used in Tor and Gary's excellent report. I think kudos to both of them and to the agency for supporting such a compellingly written report. It lays out the case very strongly. So, and I think Gary did a nice job of synopsizing the major take-home points from that. So basically, I'm here to support very strongly the recommendation for endangered status here in Washington. I'm just going to make a couple of quick points, none of which are novel, but to again try to draw attention to what I think are the most compelling patterns that have emerged from the research. And I think it is important to note that we do have somewhat limited data. This is a species that, as visible as it is, has not been that well studied throughout much of its range, including here in Washington. But despite what we recognize are limitations in the data, the patterns are both consistent and compelling across multiple different ways of assessing population trends. So the work that Scott and I undertook, for example, the boat-based colony surveys, a 57% decline, largely in the last 30 years. That's staggering when we're talking about the disappearance of colonies. Admittedly, some of those were small to start with. Multiple at-sea surveys showing remarkably good concordance, the colony counts that were done in the 80s, they're all consistent across platforms and across approaches to show that we've probably lost, you know, an order of magnitude of the population that we had 100 years ago. So 90%+ decline is quite possible. And that pattern here in Washington, in the larger context in the California current system, it's also consistent. Similar sorts of declines in Oregon and California, as well as in Japan. So really, the species is doing well in its core area, Alaska, and really struggling outside of that core range. And it kind of speaks to the issue that you raised, which is how do we deal with populations that are biologically significant but outside the core of their distribution? And I think recognizing this, there was, as Gary mentioned, there's been a petition submitted to Fish and Wildlife Service to list as a distinct population segment what's the California current system population, so Washington, Oregon, and California. And I present, is that 3 minutes? Yeah. Sorry. Okay, so I will wrap up and just say that thank you for the opportunity, and I think the real challenge now before us is to elucidate the factors that have really driven this population down over the last few decades. So thank you.
Thank you. Sean Cantrell, Elizabeth.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Roderick. I'm a wildlife biologist and vice president of the Black Hills chapter of the Audubon Society. We have over 1,300 members in the four county South Sound area who support the listing of tufted puffin as endangered. And we also want to compliment Thor and Gary on a very thorough status review. Many of our members travel around the state and watch birds during all seasons, and some have personally noted the decline in tufted puffins over the past 30 years. And as indicated in the status review, there are several factors contributing to the decline. But in addition, the National Audubon scientists have also listed the tufted puffin as high risk from the impacts of climate change. And while the listing is important because it's the beginning of the road to recovery, we know that other seabirds have declined as well. And we would like to see the department allocate funds to determine which causes of marine bird declines can be mitigated by management actions, and then to implement some early actions, such as protecting foraging habitats, and nearby populations of forage fish. we cannot really afford to wait until all the recovery plans are completed. And we'd like to see some of these early actions taken sooner. Thank you.
Thank you. The next person to come up will be Trina Bayard.
Thank you, Vice Chair. My name again is Sean Cantrell, Regional Director for Defenders of Wildlife, and I'm here to speak in favor of the endangered listing proposal for the tufted puffin. As has been said, the department and their contractors or outside entities have done a great job of detailing the status of the species, so I won't bother repeating all of that. It is very compelling, I think. Just parenthetically, prior to serving with Defenders of Wildlife, I spent 7 years as the executive director for Seattle Audubon Society. So I have a soft spot for seabirds and this species in particular. Again, as a novice birder, when I first started there, it's like, okay, that bird I can determine. I can spot that. I know what that one is. You know, talk about gulls is a whole other story. But it was one of the first birds I saw in the seabird world, and would just, at a personal level, really appreciate the department and the commission recognizing that their really dramatic decline, and start working on recovery opportunities. So with that, I will end. I don't have any comments at this time on the Stillwater Sea Lions. It's not an issue that we have been directly involved with. We may come back to you in March if we have information at that time to share. Thank you.
Thank you. Trina?
Thank you, Vice Chair and members of the Commission. My name is Trina Bayard. I'm the Director of Bird Conservation for Audubon, Washington, which is a state office of Audubon. You're hearing from a lot of Audubon folks today. I'm also here on behalf of 9 other chapters who wish to voice their support for this listing. Those chapters are the North Cascades, Skagit, Pilchuck, San Juans, Olympic Peninsula, Kitsap, Seattle, Vashon, and last but not least, Kittitas in eastern Washington. The conservation of marine birds and their forage fish prey are one of our top priorities. In fact, we're so concerned about the decline of species such as the tufted puffin that we've made marine birds and food supplies our first flyway level initiative. We recognize how climate change is acting across state boundaries, and we're working on these issues from Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California. I would like to join the other commenters in thanking the department and SeaDoc Society for advancing the status review. I recognize it's been a very long time in coming, and I would also like to join the other commenters in really urging you to move quickly to develop and implement the recovery plan for this species. As others have said, we've seen some dramatic declines in our marine birds in the last 30 years, not just the tufted puffin, and identifying the reasons for those decline is a huge missing gap in our understanding of what's going on out there. So I urge you to support the listing of this species, and I thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Thank you very much. Do we want to take a break or go into enforcement? I think we might as well do that.
I just wanted to make a statement that I thought this testimony was terrific. You all did a really excellent job, thought also that you conveyed the point that this partnership with SeaDoc was very, very beneficial to the department. I haven't read the review yet, the report yet, but I look forward to it. So it sounded just terrific. Thanks so much.